Tired of spending all evening looking for something to watch? Introducing Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky without a dish, where all your shows from all your apps and channels are in one place. Stream unmissable Sky exclusives like True Detective and The Regime starring Kate Winslet, and Netflix shows like The Gentlemen, all in one simple bill for just €25 a month for 12 months. Search Sky Stream today. New customers only. 12-month minimum term. Requires broadband. The regime available 8th of April. Further terms apply.
This week on Crime World...
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
Nominated for Best Documentary at the upcoming Irish Podcast Awards, this is Tainted Gold, the Michelle Smith story.
So the waiting is almost over now. It's up to the starter. Clean start.
I train 6 days a week. I only have one day off. I train 6 hours a day. All I do is eat, sleep and train.
Smith is not letting them get away from them, and you can hear the crowd going wild.
I think on some level, I presumed she would fail.
I don't think anybody expected what ended up happening.
100 metres to go for a second gold medal for Michelle Smith. Can anyone catch her at this stage? She's 15 metres to go to the turn.
I think I was just shocked. I think I was in shock.
She will turn for the final 50 in front. Bear in mind, Ireland has never won a swimming medal of any colour, and they're looking at gold.
Absolutely astonishing achievement. And, you know, from the moment that happened then, you know, the country went absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy.
7 short days in Atlanta propelled Irish sport in general onto an altogether different plane. Ireland's greatest Olympian, Michelle Smith.
My name is Kieran Lennon, and you are listening to Tainted Gold, the Michelle Smith story, a 3-part series that traces her rise and fall, as well as the deep scars that remain to this day. We asked Michelle Smith to contribute to this podcast, but she said she was not available. She has always denied accusations of cheating during her swimming career, and in a recent statement to RTE Radio, she said her Olympic success was a culmination of 17 years of training and dedication to her sport. Before he had introduced Ross O'Carroll Kelly to South County Dublin, Paul Howard was the chief sports writer for the Sunday Tribune, and he had covered Michelle's career when she was still struggling to make a mark on the international scene.
I'd known Michelle Smith. I sort of knew about Michelle Smith and wrote about Michelle Smith from the early 90s. I knew she had swum at the Seoul Olympics in 88 and then in Barcelona in 92. And I think I interviewed her twice before in the lead up to the Barcelona Olympics. I really liked her, you know, she was really personable and, you know, very ambitious and just good company. She went to Barcelona and she posted performances that kind of suggested this was the end for her. No one really expected her to be around in Atlanta. And I think given her kind of her age profile and didn't expect her to see her swimming internationally at that level again.
Michelle didn't get out of her heats in Barcelona and her Olympics passed by with little attention. Her performances generated only a few paragraphs in the Irish Independent underneath stories about Gary O'Toole's disappointments in the pool. However, the 1992 Games wasn't the end for her, but a turning point. And Michelle would later write about her first meeting with Eric in her diaries for the Irish Independent.
I'd finished my swimming at the 1992 Olympics and went for lunch with this Dutchman who brought his friend, Eric de Bruin, along, and we'd a good time. I thought he was nice. When lunch was finished and we were about to leave, I told myself I better act fast or this one might get away. I took a deep breath and asked, "What are you doing tonight?"
"Look, love at first sight is an old cliche, but anyone who knows them or remembers that time would say that."
That's Paul Kimmage of the Sunday Independent.
You know, it was almost the old classic turnabout.
And then it went quiet for a little bit. I mean, it might not have gone quiet, but I certainly wasn't writing much about swimming after the Olympics. And then I remember my desk in the Sunday Tribune office was right next to the fax machine. And it was really annoying because fax was just come through all day. And it was these are the days before email. I remember faxes started coming in about these performances Michelle Smith was swimming. She went to Holland to live with him, and didn't retire. And then, you know, just sort of started to not just steadily improve as a swimmer. There were astronomical improvements she was making as a swimmer. And I was learning about them through these faxes that were coming in. I can't remember who was sending them, whether it was the Irish Amateur Swimming Association or whether Michelle was sending them herself. But suddenly it was clear that something was happening. You know, she was becoming one of the best swimmers in Europe, I suppose, at that stage. And it was very unusual.
Gary O'Toole tells a story about he was at Barcelona with Michelle, obviously, and he came home and didn't see her for over a year until the World Short Course Championships in Palma de Mallorca. And he hadn't seen her in over a year. And they were in the warm-up pool before the event, and he saw her for the first time. And he was like stunned by the change in her physical appearance. She looked so much stronger than he'd remembered her before. And he made a remark to her. He remarked on this to her about, you know, look, Gidio, just I don't know what you're doing, but, you know, be careful. Now, she denies that conversation happened, okay? She denies that conversation happened, but that's Gary's remembering of it, that he saw her for the first time in over a year and that there was a noted change in her physical appearance.
And then, you know, the whispers started about Eric, that Eric had a problem with a drug test in 1993, that he had a raised testosterone to epitestosterone ratio, and that was indicative of steroid use, or that was indicative of doping.
In August, I think it was, of 93, Eric gave this testosterone positive in an event in Cologne, okay? And what was significant about that, or interesting rather about that, was that Michelle was with him that day. She traveled with him to that event in Cologne. So she saw firsthand what had happened to him and the process that followed.
I remember at the time this was kind of dismissed by a lot of people around swimming and around Michelle Smith as, you know, it was a mistake and the Dutch Federation have exonerated him and, you know, that there's nothing to see here. But I didn't, you know, I didn't buy that explanation, to be honest. You know, I made some calls and it wasn't as straightforward as the Dutch Federation have cleared him, and that's the end of it, that the IAAF did not accept the Dutch Federation's reason for clearing him, and the ban stood, and he was banned from his sport for 4 years. But this had happened while he and Michelle were sharing a home together, while they're sharing a bathroom together. You know, all of these things, the rate of improvement at a time when she should have been slowing down, you know, and that kind of relates to the changing shape of the female body as the female body matures. But we just kept hearing about this new training regime she was, you know, she was undergoing in Holland. But the problem then is when the man who's in charge of the training regime, you know, the man she called the wind beneath my wings in her book, has this, you know, this doping infraction against him. It's just very, very difficult to bury that.
I think she was very much, I would have said, under the spell of Eric.
That's Vincent Hogan, sports writer for the Irish Independent.
That, you know, he was, I don't know if controlling is the description I'd say, but she seemed to look to him after everything she did. The only reassurance she needed was from him. He was a very strong type of personality in that there was a defiance in him. And it was almost, you know, how dare you question her? But it was very noticeable that, you know, as soon as she'd finish a race or finish a heat, she'd seek to make eye contact with him And then secondly, with her parents, who were usually up in the bleachers waving a small tricolour or something. But it was always initially she looked for Eric.
Michelle would later write about her training regime with her husband in her diaries for the Irish Independent, although without ever giving much real details away.
One thing about Eric is if he decides to do something, he wants to do it properly or not at all. What he found in me was someone who is prepared to do the work and willing to listen and discuss what I was doing with him. To most people, the regime we developed would be an unbearable existence. All I did was swim and train. I train, I eat, I sleep. But you have to understand that I love my swimming and he loves the coaching. We get to live the programme all day long. Admittedly, by the time the end comes to our 10-month programme, both of us are ready for a break. But during it, we're all caught up in what we're doing. What better way of doing something than doing what you love and doing it with someone you love?
Before she raced against Michelle in Atlanta, Marianne Limpert had crossed paths with the Irish swimmer several times in the years before, and her physical transformation had not gone unnoticed.
I hadn't seen her for a while, and then we were at a World Cup, and she was there with, and I'm trying to think if they were already married, if he was still her fiancé, her husband or her fiancé at the time. And I noticed that her physical appearance had changed significantly since the last time that I'd seen her. She was a lot more muscular, a lot more cut.
When she started training with Eric, her entire body shape changed. She had big shoulders, like she developed these very, very big shoulders. And she changed to power events. She was suddenly swimming power events, events that, you know, required kind of big arms, really.
According to Michelle, her transformation was down to Eric's innovative coaching, which allowed her to reach her full potential. It was a narrative that she would tell the world in Atlanta in 1996.
No, I'm not letting anything take away from this joy because, you know, I've really worked so hard. I've put my heart and soul and my whole life into the last 3.5 years and I haven't let anything come in my way. I've tried to be as professional as I possibly can. And, you know, this is the result of it. And nothing's going to spoil that for me.
She very much created this idea that all of the coaching she had undergone before Eric was bog standard, ridiculous, and that when he came into her life, he suddenly was able to point out all the nonsense. And again, these very compelling descriptions of how much more focused and disciplined, dietary-wise, you know, training-wise.
I wouldn't have taken any notice of her until the World Championships in Rome in 1994. And that registered because she became the first swimmer to make a World Championship final, okay, in swimming history in Ireland. No other swimmer had done that before, had made a World Championship final in the 200 metres butterfly. That was never her event. She hadn't competed in a butterfly in an international competition, I don't think ever. If you look back in Seoul, she'd been preferred events was 400 IM and backstroke. So individual medley and backstroke were their two specialist events. And here she turns up at a World Championship, makes the final in the 200 metre butterfly, which was, you know, and look, I'm going to be honest here. For me, I wouldn't have understood that at the time. But if you're swimming and you're in the swimming community and you're looking at this, you're thinking, what the fuck is going on here?
But we were hearing stories about how she was training smart. And this came back during the Atlanta Olympics, that the secret behind it was that she was training a lot smarter than she had before. But when you asked what training smart meant, it was just very unconvincing. It just didn't add up to the improvements that she was getting. That was what I felt. I was dubious about whether all these changes she'd made were responsible for this improvement in her that was just about unprecedented outside of the communist world.
Her big breakthrough on the international scene would come in 1995 when she achieved something no Irish swimmer had ever achieved before.
And then she went to Vienna a year later in 95 and won two golds and a silver at the European Championships. And now she's in like uncharted territory. This is like nobody has gone near this level of performance before. How has this woman, how has she done this? How is she achieving these astonishing performances? smashing records left, right and centre, winning. I mean, many Irish records you broke, I've lost count, but you know, we should have been doing that. It was just an easy way out for us to move on and hope it wouldn't be a story in Atlanta.
However, Irish sport and Irish society was also a very different place in 1996, and doping issues in sport were a more foreign concept.
The Americans, they were caught on drugs, but no Irish person was ever caught on drugs because no Irish person ever takes drugs. The Americans are not in any position to cast aspersions on people. Michelle's got there by hard work.
Yeah, there was a certain smugness about us, definitely. We really, you know, certainly in mainstream media, we didn't for a second think that that was going to happen with our athletes. And obviously no Irish athlete had ever tested positive at the Olympics. I think probably there was an element of we're above that kind of thing in Ireland.
During the 1996 Games, while the spotlight was on Michelle in Atlanta, Paul Howard decided to dig deeper into the story of Eric de Bruyn, the leading Dutch discus thrower who had undergone his own transformation from track and field athlete into a world-class swimming coach.
During the Atlanta Olympics, I realised that Eric was the story. I wasn't in Atlanta for the Olympics. I was working on the desk in the Sunday Tribune. I was second or third in the pecking order as a sports writer at the time. So I was based in Dublin and I was thinking, how could I cover the story from this part of the world? And I thought the story was Eric. I really did. I thought, you know, we've got somebody in Atlanta covering that side of the story. I need to find out about Eric. And in those days, pre-internet, there was no Googling him. You know, it was very, very difficult to find out about Eric de Bruyn's background without going to Holland and talking to people who knew him. So that's what I did in the summer of 96. I decided, you know, this is a huge part of the story, his background, because really he was her Achilles heel. His background, his positive dope test was a weak link in the chain. It was the thing that spoiled the fairy tale story, just the one little ugly blemish that just spoiled the fairy tale story. So I went to Holland and I met a few sports journalists who knew Eric, who'd known him for years, and kind of put this picture together of what he was like. And he had done an interview with a Dutch newspaper called De Volkskrant either that year or the year before, in which he'd spoken about his attitude towards doping. And to say it was ambivalent would be generous. He talked about how Ben Johnson was the hero of the Seoul Olympics, regardless of what he'd taken. And he felt that, you know, cheating was something that went on in all aspects of life. And, you know, what was cheating for one person might not be cheating for another person. He felt that sport wasn't a level playing field anyway. And he said that doping was essentially just a list of substances that you weren't allowed to take. So it was very interesting, but it was the first sort of crack in this facade that had been constructed of the swimmer, you know, who had made these unlikely improvements and become the greatest swimmer in the world. And, you know, the Prince Charming standing behind her, who had been wronged by his sport. It was this picture was suddenly started to emerge of Eric de Bruyn as quite a different character to this discus and shot putter who'd been unfairly maligned by his sport and driven out of his sport. It was far more complicated than that. And we published the story in the Sunday Tribune in between. It was the end of the week when she won all the medals. So it was that Sunday. And yeah, suddenly after that piece appeared, it kind of felt like Eric was a problem then.
But it wasn't just Eric. Michelle faced scrutiny and questions directly. She was celebrated as an Olympic hero on her return to Dublin. But those who had asked questions during the Games were not going to drop the topic now. And for almost 2 years, they would dig deeper into her story, revealing issues with her availability for drug tests and pushed her to reveal the secrets of her success. And then, out of nowhere, in April 1998, the news broke that she was facing a charge of tampering with a drug test. Marion Limpert was one of the swimmers who had finished second to Michelle in Atlanta, and the news shocked her.
totally caught me off guard. We were actually preparing for the Commonwealth Games in Malaysia in 98. So we had just, I'm trying to think if we had just come off the meet and we were getting ready for the camp. But anyway, we were leaving it and yeah, it came out of nowhere. Like I just know one of our media attachés kind of said, look, okay, just so you know, you're probably going to have to do some interviews because this is just broken. And I was like, what?
On the morning of January 10th, 1998, part-time drug testers Alan K. Guy drove up to the gates of Michelle and Eric's Kilkenny home for an out-of-competition drug test, as they had done many times before. Michelle would unlock the gates and return to the house, and when Alan K. entered to collect the urine sample, Michelle was out of sight. The Olympic champion would say she only disappeared for a minute, but Alan K. Guy's report said it was more like 5. Either way, they would soon be joined by Eric, and the four of them would wait until Michelle felt ready to deliver the sample in the downstairs bathroom. Back in the kitchen, the sample was split into 2 containers and signed off, and it was here both testers first noted the whiff of alcohol in the air. 3 months later, the bomb would go off in Irish sport when the Times of London broke the news that Michelle was facing a charge of tampering with the drug test and a possible 4-year ban.
I think that the tampering, it didn't make any sense. I mean, there were allegations. I remember the defence of Peter Lennon, her solicitor, they were saying, you know, they were kind of, well, when was it sealed and all of this. And you're being almost asked to believe that Alan K. Guy would have done this. And you're kind of saying, well, that's not believable. That's not credible.
I mean, I thought it was completely ludicrous, but she had to say something.
We spoke to Al Guy for this podcast, but he didn't want to be recorded. He says he'd prefer to leave it all in the past. However, he did say he knew Michelle's legal team would try and target him and his wife Kay in the process of their defence. They had few other options. As a customs and excise officer, he had grown a thick skin. Al has just turned 80, but it's easy to see he had the personality to stand up to the pressure and scrutiny at the time. But the whole episode weighed heavier on his wife Kay.
I thought about it many, many times, how much I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that kitchen that day. I mean, because the tension there must have been, you know, and then the tampering. And there was whiskey in the sample. But I went to the press conference in Heather Lennon, solicitor's office on the Quays, on City Quay. It's one of those kind of 10 days you'll always, 10 working days you'll always remember from your career, because it was... It just felt like the final reckoning. It was an extraordinary day, a horrible day, a tense day, and you could kind of see that she was a wreck over this.
So it became a case of, for them being legally very clever, rather than, in my opinion, addressing what was in front of all of our noses, and they were very clever. And she was very strident. I mean, the same steel that you saw in her eyes in Atlanta was still there. But did I believe it? No, I didn't believe it at that stage. You just knew this doesn't add up. This doesn't add up. Like, I mean, it's only in one person's interest to tamper with it if it needs to be tampered with. Only in one person. So I think the game was up.
Vincent Hogan and the Irish Independent had been among those who had backed Michelle in the 2 years after Atlanta. But given the dramatic events of 1998, that support was becoming unsustainable.
And yet the instinct, I suppose, as a journalist, maybe is to kind of dance around it a bit. You know, when I think of, you know, the editorial I was asked to write, and I think of the big piece I wrote at the time, it was very much trying not to say, I messed up, trying not to say I got it wrong. It was kind of broad brush strokes about how sport in general is disease ridden. And, you know, even at that stage, and that's 2 years after Atlanta, I think I still see a kind of self-serving dishonesty in what I was saying, because at that stage, I didn't believe a word that was coming from Michelle or you know, I just didn't believe her story at all. And yet, you know, and it's not my proudest time as a journalist. I couldn't bring myself to say what was the bleeding obvious, you know, this stinks. The whole thing just stinks.
On August 6th, 1998, she was officially hit with a 4-year ban by FINA, swimming's governing body, for tampering with the sample. It was 2 years to the day since Michelle returned to Dublin as a hero. She had few people in her corner now, but she wasn't ready to give up the fight. She denied any involvement in the tampering case or any sort of cheating and was determined to clear her name at the Court of Arbitration for Sport.
On my life, I swear that I am innocent.
August 7th, 1998. Front page of the Irish Independent.
I'm not a cheat and never have been. I did not lie or mislead anyone about my achievements at the Olympics, the Europeans, or at any time throughout my entire career in swimming. Right now, I intend to take my case to the Sports Arbitration Court, where all the facts will be presented.
But the appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport was a bruising experience for Michelle, where the evidence against her was heard in public.
Dr. Segura was asked why anybody would want to put alcohol into a urine sample. He said it would be an attempt to mask the presence of a banned substance.
Her legal defence would also have to prove their theory that it was possible to tamper with the containers her samples were stored in after they were sealed.
There was a scenario put forward, or a suggestion of what possibly happened, that someone had tampered with, somebody had tampered with the container containing the urine sample during transit, which opened up the question of, like, who would bother? And then it was suggested that people had been out to get her. Apparently there was a site on an internet site, which, again, all this stuff is new at the time. The internet was new. We had just got it in the Sunday Tribune office. But there was an internet site where apparently if you boiled the container that the beaker of urine came in, you could actually pop the lid and then you could get it and tamper with it and put it back and put the lid back on without it displaying any evidence of tampering. And when she appealed the FINA ban on her to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, one of the things was her legal team had to actually demonstrate how this might conceivably happen in laboratory conditions, and they tried and they failed. They couldn't do it in a way that left no evidence on the beaker.
Dr. Jordi Segura from the lab in Barcelona also introduced some more damning evidence.
The absolute game changer was when they brought in the head of the Barcelona lab.
Tonight, Dr. Segura of the IOC-accredited lab in Barcelona that carried out analysis of the disputed January 10th, 1998 sample, gave his evidence. During that, the lawyer for FINA, Jean-Pierre Morand, attempted to reintroduce claims that traces of a metabolic precursor of testosterone, that's namely a banned substance, were found in a separate analysis of the disputed January 10th, 1998 sample A. Now, this was vigorously opposed by De Bruyn's solicitor, Peter Lennon, who said it was an attempt to introduce new evidence into the case. The panel said it would be taken into reserve.
They weren't able to actually identify it as Andros and Dion at the time they had brought the tampering charge, okay? It was in the case, as it was presented to her, it was presented as a testosterone precursor. They weren't able to identify it at the time, but subsequently they were able to identify it as Andro, and this then became part of, if you want, the lab's evidence in the hearing. And that was really significant because the question was, and I've got it here, it was an interview that Eric gave to Cathal Derwin in the Title. So the front page of the Title on February 14, 1999, which is the run-up to the Cass, we're waiting on the Cass hearing at this stage. And there's a picture of Michelle and Eric on the front page of the Title, and there's an interview with Eric inside with Cathal Derwin on February 14, 1999. And the quote over the front page photograph is, "Would somebody please God tell me why Michelle would put ethanol in a sample that did not contain a banned substance?" Okay, Now, ethanol was the alcohol. Would somebody please God tell me why Michelle would put ethanol in a sample that did not contain a banned substance? And the answer came from Jordi Segura at the CAS hearing. It did contain a banned substance. And a subsequent test contained a banned substance, the same banned substance, and one just before that. So that was it. Game over.
The Court of Arbitration upheld the four-year ban, which effectively ended the career of Michelle Smith, who was 29 at the time.
The game was up then. She announced very, very soon after the CAS ruling, that day, I think, that she was retiring from public life as well. Like, you know, she wouldn't be commenting on this at all, and just sort of, she would be accepting. And it was the end of the road because there was nowhere else to go after CAS ruled. But that was the end of it. You know, that was the end of the story.
Michelle would not compete in the pool again and would return to university to study law, embarking on a new career. But the effects of her time in the pool are still being felt today. The doping controversy and the events around it would have personal and professional consequences far beyond Michelle and Eric. It cost friendships, careers, and took a personal toll on many of those involved in this story. Coming up in episode 3, Tainted Gold, the Michelle Smith story.
In my heart, I do feel like I had the best swim on that night in Atlanta, and you know, in the history books and on paper, that's not the case, but that's, you know, for me, that way I have some peace.
It did scar me in a sense, in that it became very, very divisive between journalists. Like, I wouldn't have had a civil word between myself and Paul Kimmich for 15 or 20 years after that.
The people who were damaged were Michelle, her family, her friends, and the people who loved and admired her for what she was in 1992.
You've been listening to Tainted Gold. This was produced by Kieran Lennon and Shane Brennan, with sound design from John Smith. Thanks to RTE for the use of archive audio. Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.